Welcome to the League of Most podcast. This is Zachary Strebeck, your host and the resident game lawyer. Today, we're talking to tabletop game designer and publisher, Patrick Nickel.
Nickel.
Okay.
Well, that's the funny thing is I don't actually know how to say my last name.
Okay.
My dad says it one way. Grandpa says it the other. I don't know who wins. Grandpa has passed away. Dad is still with us. So does dad win now? I don't know how to say my last name.
Well, like me, I spell my first name Zachary with an H, but when I spell it with just Zach, it's with a K. So that usually confuses people too. I can't decide. Yep. I like the look of the K better.
Perpetual state of confusion. Yep,
exactly.
Yeah, because nobody likes the name Zach.
That's true. Exactly. It looks weird to me. But Zachary with a K looks odd too. So I don't know.
Yeah, the glory of the English language.
Well, you are the publisher known as Crash of Games. Correct. So welcome to you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, we kind of skipped over the rest of that sentence I had written down. That's fine. I never know how to pronounce people's names. I'm pretty awful.
That's quite all right.
Yeah. So I always start off getting the background of the guest. So where are you from? How'd you get into the game industry?
Sure. I grew up on the island of Maui and in San Diego. Those are the two places that I call home. And I've been an avid gamer my entire life, from Atari and Nintendo Entertainment System. I still remember the smell of that first Nintendo in 1985, and got into tabletop gaming relatively young. Started with backgammon and cribbage, mm-hmm. and moved into hobby gaming in 1998. With this crazy new game that had just come out of Germany called Settlers of Catan. Apparently, we're all gonna stumble our way through this podcast.
No problem. This is
The game that really awoken my love for hobby gaming was Tikal. And so, how long ago was this? Yeah, geez, about 7 years ago, I started into the industry via the retail side as the manager of a game store. And then as that opportunity came to an end just over a year later, there was this brand new thing called Kickstarter. And I was like, oh, okay, well, this is kind of – I think I can make some games. And the rest is history.
Excellent. So what was your first Kickstarter that you ran?
So the first Kickstarter that my ex-business partner, Michael Coe, who is now the founder of Gameland Games, we Kickstarted a game called Rise. And it was a two-player abstract strategy game. It was a really interesting, Kickstarter campaign, and we had done a 60-day campaign, which looking back on that, man, that's a masochistic nightmare.
Right.
And in the first 30 days, we had only had, you know, a third of our funding. And then we kind of switched gears, you know, after listening to a podcast from Richard Bliss, Funding mm-hmm. the Dream, super helpful podcast. And it sparked an idea while Michael and I were in my car driving to our first BGG con. And then we changed things around and marketed the campaign a different way. And in the second 30 days, we got 2/3 of our funding and it was successful. And that was the start of it.
What was the funding goal for that, for your first game?
Oh, I think we had the funding goal set somewhere around like 12,000 or 13,000. Gosh, it's been so long. I can click on the handy dandy power of the internet, man. That seems like a lifetime ago. So we had funded at 116%. So we had $17,518 pledged. And I think our goal, cause it doesn't really show what the goal was. I think it was roughly 15 grand.
Okay.
Huh. Yeah, it was 15. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. Man. I mean, it seems for back then, it seems like a lot actually. Because
it was one of the earlier goes. At this point, when we had launched this, you know, there had only really been three successful like campaigns in my mind. You know, not to diminish other people that had established themselves, and that was Clever Mojo Games with Alien Frontiers, Tasty Minstrel with Eminent Domain, mm-hmm. and Dice Hate Me Games with Carnival. And that was really kind of the kickoff. You know, our campaign, I think, came just under like 8 or 9 months after Alien Frontiers, which was kind of like one of the first ones. So it was the first time in my life where I wasn't behind the eight ball on an opportunity. And I'm very, very thankful for that, because it is an ever, ever changing environment and climate.
Sure.
And we got in just enough time that as the years progressed, we kind of had that grandfathered in, you know, people had that view of us of like, oh, okay, well, no, they were early adopters. They've been here a while. So we kind of had that vetted trust built in a little bit.
Right. Well, that was going to be my question. So what do you think, what are the major things that have changed on Kickstarter and the crowdfunding space in general since then?
Oh, geez, this is a 3-hour podcast now. So it does change. It is ever changing, and every project that it's glorious. It's kind of this big living thing. Every project that goes through Kickstarter changes Kickstarter in some ways. It may be a very small, minor way. It may be a very big, major way. And I think what has changed is what made Kickstarter so beautiful in its beginning was it was about like the name of Richard's podcast. It was about funding a dream.
Yep.
Right. It was people that had an idea, that had a dream, and needed other people to believe in it and support it, you know, financially to make it happen. And that was good enough. And that was enough. People got a thing and they supported a dream and they seemed really by that. And over time, people's expectations shifted. It was no longer was the dream possible. It was now assumed that the dream would happen.
Right.
And it now became a, what are you going to give me? There were some projects that exercised some very bad buyer behavior. And I just wrote a blog post about this like a week ago, because I had some friends, fellow publishers going through a tough time with sort of an entitlement issue. And it spurred me to write a blog post about it. But there were a couple projects that really exercised some bad encouraged bad buyer behavior. And now the climate that I feel Kickstarter is today is I want more than I would get in the store. Mm-hmm. I want it for less money. And don't you dare miss your estimated delivery date. And that is a really tough way to operate. It's really impossible.
Right.
I feel.
Yeah, it's almost like you're taking real investors, right? Real equity investors. That's sort of the attitude they have, right? But it's a very different situation, I think.
Well, and the trouble is, and I started a bit of a flame war for myself because I was misunderstood, and I had said, you know, the baked in, I can't remember the verbiage I used, something like the baked in equity or the baked in, you know, entitlement that a $20 customer has is very different than a $50,000 customer has. Right. So if somebody decides to back my company and invest $50,000 in it, I am going to really hear their opinion because they've cared enough to pony up the cash.
Right.
Now, this isn't to say that the person that gave me $20 opinion doesn't matter. No, that's not how I operate. I want every voice to be heard. But those $20 opinions are all over the map. And sometimes they're rooted in fact and education, and sometimes they're rooted in emotion and insanity. And right. So you can't listen to every person, but the person that, you know, has thought about it, because, you know, again, and it's not about the dollar amount that's attached. It's what is behind that dollar amount. Right. Someone isn't going to willy-nilly throw 50 grand into my company, whereas someone could completely impulsively throw 20 in.
Yep.
So that just means that the amount of thought that has gone into that investment, you know, is substantial. And so again, what I am not saying is that opinions aren't important. Everyone's opinion is valid, and I always want to hear everybody, because I think that is one of our problems across the board, is that we don't take enough time to listen to people. And they may be completely off their rocker, but as long as you hear someone, then they have that opportunity to express themselves. So everybody should be heard. Every opinion is valid, but not every opinion should be acted upon.
Sure. And yeah, I would say that With that low barrier to entry, which is a $20 pledge or just signing up for a forum or something like that. Maybe those opinions are more important in the aggregate rather than any one opinion, right?
Yeah. If 40 people if 40 people that have pledged $20 or, you know, maybe a dollar, maybe nothing, or just on an online forum, if 40 people are saying the same thing, there's probably some validity to it, and probably even less, you know, if 20 people, 10 people, you know, I don't know what number you want to, you know, attach to that, but, you know, and that can be the glorious thing, right? And that is where it becomes a numbers game, is if enough people are saying a thing, you should pay attention to it. There's something off.
Absolutely. Yeah. Do you run into any big problems? I mean, you said that you sort of sparked some ire with your blog post, but as far as working the PR aspect of things or the community building aspects of things, what would you say are the biggest challenges for developers there?
Well, and thankfully, you know, I'm about a year removed from having ran a Kickstarter project. So, and Crash of Games doesn't operate on Kickstarter anymore. One of the nice advantages of becoming a Geek Sheet company is that, you know, my funding doesn't need to be crowdsourced. Right. And that was very, very difficult, you know, because it basically what I would tell people in a nutshell is it was having to make two different versions of a game and sell it twice. It's hard enough to make one version and sell it. It becomes really hard to do a second. So to circle back to your question, though, and I'm sorry, could you repeat it one more time?
Do you have any?
I talked myself down a rabbit hole.
What kind of difficulties do you have dealing with the community or the PR side of things? Right.
So it always depends on the community that you're dealing with. The you know, community can dictate, you know, how you should communicate to it. But I really always try to just be me, regardless of who I'm talking to. And the great part about that is that I'm never going to trip up. I'm never going to, you know, catch myself off foot, because I am me, and that's all that I can do and all that I can be. And so I always just try to be very honest and transparent with people and let them know that, hey, you know, I am trying to make a thing that I love, that hopefully you love or at least like a little bit.
Yep.
And, you know, this is what that looks like and what that means. And I think that, you know, it's really difficult for people to put themselves into other people's shoes in any regard, right? I would say that, you know, our country suffers from a severe lack of compassion.
Sure.
Generally, and that'll follow itself to any industry and any community. But it's, I feel, even more difficult to put yourself in the shoes of a creator and to realize the stress, the pressure, you know, what timelines look like. And it's just an entire world that I had no idea about until I was in the thick of it.
Yep.
And so it's really hard for you to appreciate and understand someone's perspective. Like, for example, with Yardmaster, Pater and Yardmaster Express, those were all due to arrive at about the same time. I was trying to game the system and save people, you know, save money on shipping. I ended up spending, I think, close to $30,000 on shipping. It darn near sunk my company. And people were super – there were a select few that were just insanely upset that I was going to sell those products at Essen Spiel in Germany before them getting their Kickstarter project. You know, to be fair, I had made them a promise and I had broken that promise.
Yeah.
And so I am on the hook for that. And I took full credit for that. But I was trying to communicate to them, like, look, you know, I'm $8,000 into this trip. And if I don't sell games there, it can quite possibly sink my company. That is that thin of a profit margin at this point, to where I can't afford to take an $8,000 bath. I mean, I put tens of thousands of dollars of my wife and I's own money into my company. I never made money off of Crash Games. Mm-hmm. It was too young. I rolled that money back into infrastructure to grow. And there were people that were just livid. There were threats. Oh my gosh, it was really ugly. Wow. And I'm like, hey guys, gain some perspective.
Right.
You know, and unfortunately those maniacal, you know, zealots right. that that I used to love because they were in my corner. Some of them had turned, but the most people and the majority of people were overwhelmingly, you know, sympathetic and supportive. But, you know, that kind of gets drowned out because the, what I refer to as the vocal minority, and sure, they are extremely vocal, can really bring you down. So, you know, as far as how I deal with the PR of it, you know, I'm just honest and upfront with people. And I tell them, like, look, if I don't do this, I'm done. Yep. And there were some people who were like, well, good, then be done. Give us our game. I'm like, wow. Okay. Wow. Clearly you're a reasonable individual. Right. So I need to, you know, not communicate with you anymore.
Yeah. I think I find as I get older, I've really stopped caring about all this. There's so much. I mean, I go on the internet and I talk about movies and TV shows, mm-hmm, and things like that. And people get so upset about things. For instance, I don't know if you watched The Walking Dead, but people have been very angry about this cliffhanger at the end of The Walking Dead a couple weeks ago. And I'm just thinking, why are you expending this much energy on a TV show?
I have a theory as to why people get upset. And this is what I try to do when I'm in the thick of it. And mm-hmm, it can be difficult because the raw emotion of everything.
Right.
But I am a very empathetic individual, and I always want to try to put myself in someone else's shoes, because the most profound piece of advice I received about a year and a half ago was from the very famous author, Patrick Rothfuss. Mm-hmm. And I was on the Joko Cruise, and Pat was given a little talk, and I'll save you the story. But what it basically came down to is you can never judge a person without knowing their context. And sure, you can't possibly know their full context. And so I try to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. Like, if I'm in traffic and someone cuts me off and flips me off, you know, maybe they are speeding to the hospital because their wife is critically injured.
Sure.
So I don't need to necessarily be upset at that individual because I don't know their context, because I have been in a car speeding to a hospital because my then girlfriend, now wife, was critically injured and I needed to get to that hospital. And I'm sure those people were like, this guy's driving like a maniac. Should I have been driving that way? No. But did I have a reason for it? Yeah. And they didn't know my context. So I think when people get crazy upset about like a cliffhanger of The Walking Dead, or because they didn't get their copy of Yardmaster before somebody in Germany did, right, it stems from two things. One, they really love what they're getting or what they're watching. And then I think that maybe they have some unresolved issues in their life that they don't really have control over. And so this becomes a very cathartic and easy channel for that emotion to flow through, right? So maybe their relationship with their significant other isn't going very well, and they don't really know how to tackle that problem. But oh, it can very easily come out if they were told they might get a thing in October and they have to wait until December.
Right.
No, so
that makes sense.
That's my working theory. And I think that I'm right. I mean, some people are just dicks, you know, pardon my yes, language, that's but fine. That's just what some people are. And you can't change that. But I'd like to think that, you know, and the way that I'm able to function and manage these individuals and still, you know, not, you know, climb into my bathtub with a toaster is to exercise some empathy and go, you know what? They're probably upset about something else and they're taking it out on me. You know, it's right, no different than when you're getting bullied or picked on. That bully isn't really trying to target you. They're targeting themselves and they don't know how.
Right. So you imagine that there's context for everything and that it makes sense. And
it has completely changed my disposition and has taken so much frustration and anger outside of me and created an understanding platform that allows me to keep my sanity.
Now, see, I feel it's the opposite way. I stop getting hung up on those goofy things that don't actually really matter. And I guess having more perspective has helped me to not get upset by every little thing.
Sure. Right. Perspective is an invaluable thing.
Yeah, I agree. All right. Well, let's talk about being a publisher.
We can keep this going. This is some profound stuff.
Yeah, Zach. I think it may be too much for our audience.
Too much, maybe. Yeah,
yes, they come for the games. What? So you're a publisher. How much would you say you publish your own designs versus designs that you've either licensed or purchased from other developers?
Sure. So I cringed when you called me a designer, because while I technically am, I don't identify as one. I've designed one game and I've co-designed some stuff, you know, here and there, but that is not my talent base. Okay. Like, I just really struggle with it, and I admire people that are able to whip something up.
Yeah, I feel the same way.
The Mike Fitzgeralds, the Eric Langs, the Mike Selinkers, you know, Mike Elliott, a lot of Mikes. So it's a Mike heavy design community. You know, I really, really admire, you know, what they do, but my primary function and talent, you know, lies in being, a developer and a publisher and able to, you know, help other people bring their creations to life.
Me too. I am the same way.
Cool. So yeah, that's kind of what gets me going. And so most of the stuff that I do, almost all of the stuff now, is stuff that another designer has brought to me. And then, you know, myself and my development team comb through it and try to make it the best game possible.
Right.
And if it's already cooked, if it's already done, great. Let's get some art on it and get it to market. You know, it's not a case of, I feel like I've got to put my own spin on it, or, you know, got to put, you know, my thumb in the pie. If the pie is ready, let's sell it.
Okay. So you sort of touched on all the things I want to ask about. So how do you find these new games to publish? So are people submitting them, or are you just sort of walking around cons and prototype events and finding them, or how does that work?
So it's a myriad of ways. I in the beginning, it was much, much harder when I didn't have any credibility and people had really no reason to trust me, you know, and I think that's changed since then, which is great, because it was a lot of extra work trying to go to a designer and be like, hey, trust me to publish your game. Now they know that they can trust me to publish their game. So I get a lot of pitches. I get some stuff blindly sent to me, which is the worst way to try to pitch a game to me. You know, I'll have a lot of designers that meet up with me at conventions, which is a really great way to pitch, and will show me their game. And sometimes I see a game that I like enough and I'll reach out, you know, to the designer. For example, I saw a game on Twitter that was out of Taiwan, in the Taiwan board game design community. They were in Tokyo for the earlier game fair this year, and I'll be going next month for the main one in May. And I reach out to them, go, hey, this game looks really cool. Can you send me a copy? You know, here, I'll pay for the shipping, I'll pay for the game. You know, and then I'll reach out to them and go, hey, I'm interested in publishing this, and here's what I think I could do, you know, et cetera. So sometimes I will solicit a game if I like it enough. And a lot of times that happens is generally an international title. So a game out of Germany, a game out of Poland, a game out of Taiwan or Japan, you know, because the opportunities for those are a lot different than a designer pitching to me.
You said that blind playtest or blind submissions were the worst way to do it. Is there any way to make that not the worst way? Maybe communicating with you beforehand or meeting you somewhere?
So, yeah, the blind submissions is just like, I've had people literally send me a thing with no name. I don't know who it's from. I don't know what it is. And it's like, hey, you know, the reality is my time is really limited and I've got a lot to do. Right. And, you know, if they would just contact me and let me know, hey, I've got this game, you know, I could tell them like, oh, okay, well, I can either think about this now, and this either sounds like it might be a good fit or not a good fit, or, hey, I'm going to be at these shows, you know, flag me down. We'll make some time. I'll sit down and look at your game. But yeah, I don't know of a way to make the blind submission not the worst, because it just is. There's no respect to my time or schedule. There's generally very little information. And it's like, hey, I know that this cost you money to send me the prototype and it cost you money to put it in the postage. And, you know, I don't want to cost you that money if it's something that I'm not going to be interested in.
Sure.
You know, it's a four binder, you know, like Agricola on steroids. That's not a good fit for me.
Right.
You know, so let me save you all of that time. You know, I don't want to be the bad guy that, you know, doesn't get back to you, because I mean, I didn't ask for it. So, you know, the commitment level there is I don't really owe you a response. And then I feel guilty because I don't want to leave them out to dry. But I can't respond to every blind submission. It just isn't possible.
Right. Well, and I would say as a lawyer, if I were someone's lawyer, I would be telling them not to accept these blind submissions only because it prevents potential intellectual property issues. Like they send you the game and then you don't even look at it, but you release a game that is very similar or has some sort of.
Yeah. Generally what I do now is, and this really breaks my heart to have to do this, but when I get a blind submission now, I'll either mark it, return to sender, or I'll just chuck it in the garbage.
Yeah. That's what I would tell people to do as well. I mean, you'll find that very few creative industries will allow blind submissions like that without some sort of signed submission agreement.
Yeah. Because you've hit the nail on the head. What if I'm working on a game about, you know, 1920s bridge building, mm-hmm. and, you know, I get this submission, you know, about a game that's about 1920s bridge building, and, you know, the designer's like, oh, you stole, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they'd have a very difficult time, as you know, right. is, you know, theme and stuff really, unless it's a specific IP, can't be copyrighted, can't be trademarked, but sure. I don't want to go through that.
Yeah,
it
doesn't prevent them from trying to make a bunch of legal maneuvers at you.
That's the great thing about our country is everybody has a right to be heard in the legal channel.
You can sue anyone for anything. It doesn't mean you have to win, but yeah.
Nope.
You can always do it. Yeah. Yeah. And there are a number of cases from the movie industry that sort of solved all these problems. And that's why, you know, a movie company will not take a submission without it being through an agent or something like that.
Yeah. So that's, and that's what I tell people, you know, I'm like, hey, don't do blind submissions yet. And yet I still get them.
Now you had a perfect segue because you talked about whether or not a game would fit with your catalog and the rest of mm-hmm. your games. So I screwed that up. I asked about the legal stuff, but what qualities do you look for in a game? How do you decide whether something fits into your company's catalog of games?
So I never had that direction before when I was going it alone. You know, I was very proud of the fact that I didn't have a brand or direction because I wanted just to make, you know, a bunch of games that were fun. And that was the criteria. That was the brand. Is it a fun, engaging game? Can I make it, you know, look awesome? Absolutely. Then let's make it. But now, you know, 5 years into this, you know, my perspective has shifted. My perspective has changed. And what Crash a Game's brand is now are games that are very easy to learn, but that doesn't mean that they suffer from engaging gameplay or the ability, you know, replayability. You know, can it hit the table a dozen plus times and still be fun and fresh? You know, games that are approachable for the gamer and the non-gamer alike, not easy to do, you know, and we've kind of developed some internal lines, you know, of different styles of games, you know, that it's going to take people a while to see. You know, it's going to probably take about a year for the industry to notice. And then it'll take somewhere from 2 to 3 years for the general public to be like, oh yeah, like this is a Crash game. Like when you pick up one of Stonemaier games, right? Mm-hmm. Jamie and his partner, Alan, I believe. Maybe I'm getting his name wrong. I'm sorry.
Alan Stone. Yeah.
Yeah. Are very, very great at what they do. And you pick up a Stonemaier game, you know that it is. Like, you know, from Viticulture, Euphoria, Scythe. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have a brand. Greater Than Games has a very good brand. Dice Hate Me has a very distinct brand. You know, all of these companies have a distinct brand. And it's just going to take some time for people to see, you know, our new brand. And that's okay. You know, that, you know, it's not too different, you know, than what, you know, from a financial perspective of a phrase I've learned in the last year called a burn rate, you know, right? And it's not too different from there being basically a burn rate on perception of brand. So it'll take some time for people to notice, but I think when they do, be like, yeah, okay, yeah, this is a Crash of Games game. Right. Yeah, they'll get it.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that's a hugely important part of branding, which is, you know, normally I concentrate on the trademark side of things, but, you know, imputed in that is the, like you say, what's the public perception of your brand and what do people know they're getting when they pick up something with your logo on it that maybe they don't, they haven't played before, they haven't seen before, but they want to.
Yeah. Know. And that's what anybody that sells a thing, that's what it's all about is, yep. is what's the value of your brand? Because so many times I will without fail pick up any game that the German publisher Hans im Glück makes. Mm-hmm. And they previously licensed here in the US with Rio Grande and now with Z-Man/F2Z. Mm-hmm. And I will pick up any Hans im Glück game because I know what their brand is. I know that I'm going to get a medium to medium heavyweight Euro with some pretty good mechanics, with a fantastic component quality, and good table presence. And so I don't have to really vet the game. I can pick it up and know that it's about an 80% chance I'm going to like it. Yes. So that's the power of branding.
Can you define the term table presence? What do you mean by that? Sorry,
sure. That's fine. And that's table presence is an important part of the Crash of Games brand moving forward. So table presence is if someone is walking by mm-hmm. a demo table and you're at a convention, you have a game out there, is the game visually engaging enough to attract their attention, perhaps right. even make them stop and investigate?
Right.
So a game like Jenga, for mm-hmm. example. Great table presence. It's this tower. It's got holes in it. Stuff is falling.
Yep.
You know, it's very engaging. You know, a game like Yardmaster that I make, the art is stark. It's very distinct. Mm-hmm. And while it doesn't necessarily fit the definition of good table presence because it's flat, right, and there isn't a lot to see, that those colors and that art style would hopefully be enough to grab your attention. Whereas right. a game that we have coming out this summer called Fish Frenzy, designed by Brett J. Gilbert, it's got these boat boards and these awesome chunky, you know, fish tokens and these wooden seagull tokens and fantastic mm-hmm. art by this super talented Quan Chai Maria. That has table presence. That will get someone to stop to look and to investigate. That is a game essentially advertising itself. It's evoking its own internal brand and shouting, you know, hey, look at me, right. play me, you know.
Now, speaking of artwork, when a designer does pitch you a game, should they have final artwork or theming?
No.
I knew the answer to that, but I wanted to get your opinion on it.
Yeah, no, that is extremely problematic, both from a legal perspective right. and from a theme perspective. Okay. The theme that they've put on it may or may not be the theme that I go with. And theme is super important sure. to me, you know, and it could be super important to a game. There are trends in theming and you may or may not want to follow those trends. And not to mention from a legal perspective, like what is their contractual agreement with Absolutely. Artists? Do they own the art outright? Is it on residual? Is it on, you know, is it a time-based thing? You know, and that becomes another thing that I have to deal with. And I just assume not.
Right. So as lawyers, we call that checking the chain of title, right? To make sure that they have the title or the rights to that artwork. And like mm-hmm. you say, yeah, it's problematic because you don't want to be buying into an obligation like that, right? You'd rather just be working with the designer and then you have your own setup. Maybe you have artists that you work with already that are on
a deal. I have a regular group of artists that mm-hmm. I work with and they all work kind of differently, but we all have our individual agreements and it's very important for me to own my art because moving forward, you know, and progressing as a company and a brand, there are going to be things that extend outside of the game right. that will go on other physical properties to enhance the brand. And if I don't own the art, I can't do that.
I agree. I mean, even if you have a license that's pretty expansive, I don't know, still there are limitations there that you
yeah, I don't want to have to check back in. Like, correct. I can't imagine, like, I know what it's like for companies like USAopoly that deal with a lot of licensing. And I know what it's like to deal with a licensed IP where you then have to make the thing and then you have to submit it for their approval and they're going to look at it and say, ah, this isn't quite right. You need to change this. And it just becomes a business, you know, perspective where you're mm-hmm. operating with a perpetual permission giving. And hey, if it's Avengers, that's not a bad deal, right? You're going to sell a ton of whatever you're making. So maybe it's worth it, but you know, it can really, really slow things down. And you know, I know that I'll maybe eventually deal with it, but probably not, you know, with a big license. So, right. It just makes things exponentially more difficult.
I agree. But so from your perspective as a publisher, when you're getting pitched games, if they have sort of, you know, artwork borrowed off the internet or just iconic artwork, you're okay with that? A lot of developers or designers are especially first time designers are very concerned about that. Making your game look as good as possible, but.
And that's not a bad idea. Like I had a local designer here in the office and I really like his game and my team really likes his game and odds are we're going to pick the game up. And he did pay for art. He paid for art from a very talented comic book artist. Mm-hmm. And I let him know, like, look, I'm probably not going to use the art. We may have some crossover, you know, opportunity, you know, based on that artist's, you know, install or fan base, mm-hmm. you know, their install base is what I normally call it, you know, but we're probably going to redo the art. However, you know, number one, do you own the art? Yeah, they do. Excellent. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, number two, I want to tell you your art helped sell your game. So that's kind of like the very cautionary asterisk that I want to add on to it. Is if your game is visually engaging, then it's lowered that barrier because what people aren't really talking about very much that I would love to get in here and share, you know, my opinion on is that it has taken me 7 years to realize that how the game plays is about number four on the list of getting a person to pick it up off the shelf and buy it.
Yeah.
Now, how the game plays will dictate how long it sells, right? Of what I call an evergreen title.
Yeah.
You know, a game that's going to sell 10,000 plus units and be, you know, have a nice steady stream of sales for however long, right? Like look at like Ticket to Ride. Is that the best art ever? No, it's pretty good, but the gameplay is so amazing that it will continue to sell millions of units. But, you know, how a game looks. The art is what captures people. People are buying something that looks amazing, both the art, the components, and how it's presented, right? What box it comes in, how the components feel, and then they get around to the gameplay.
I wholeheartedly agree. And I guess, yeah, the gamer inside of you wants to say, no, it's all about the gameplay. But I mean,
it's not. There's games I can't kick out of my collection that are not very good gameplay because they're pieces of art. They're amazingly beautiful. Like I have struggled tremendously with a couple of those. I'm like, I'm not playing this. I've got to get, but it's so pretty.
Right.
You know, I got to get rid of it.
And if a game has bad art, I don't really want to play it as much just because you need to look at that bad art the whole time. And just
well, and the example I always use for that is Carl Chudik's Innovation, right? That first, you know, incarnation of the game was a terrible graphic design. It looks like it was made in, you know, Microsoft PowerPoint, but the gameplay is so amazing. Now, one of the really confusing things to me was that, you know, Asmodee Games licensed that to Yellow and then Yellow put out a very colorful and much better version of it here in the US and it wasn't an international thing and yet they still make Innovation. So it's like, I don't know, like they did like a art heavy version of it. And I'm sure, you know, Chris Seslick is a great guy. I'm sure he's like, nah, yeah, there could be a second version of this. I don't care. You know,
I didn't think it was that bad. I enjoyed the original Innovation, but maybe I'm alone. I thought that I could never get anyone to play it with me because I think something about that game,
well, I would never play it because of how it looked. And I had, you know, Marguerite with Card Kingdom and Mox to thank. Uh-huh. You know, we were hanging out at Mox one night and she threw it down on the table. I'm like, sure, I've always kind of seen this and it's, you know, sells so well. I've got to play it. I'm like, oh, this is super fantastic. It's swingy as all get out and it's mayhem.
Yeah, I think that's why I couldn't get people to play it. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the very, you know, staunch strategy gamers are like, oh, that's broken.
Yep.
I'm like, yeah, it's broken, but it's gloriously broken.
Yeah. All right. So what value do you find in going to conventions? I mean, obviously it's important to me since you go to them, but what do you as a publisher get out of it? And what could other people get out of going to conventions that should make it a priority for them?
Sure. So it depends where they are kind of in their life cycle, you know, how they're involved in the industry. Mm-hmm. And then based upon how they're involved in the industry, kind of where they are in their life cycle. Cause I'm going through a really interesting transition with conventions right now. And I'm burnt out, Zach. I've been going to them for 5 years nonstop all over the world, and they are draining, but they're so awesome. And so it's such a hard,
I agree. Yeah.
You know, it's such a hard thing to decide. But also as my company grows, my time is in more demand. And in a nutshell, a convention costs me 3 weeks of my time. Mm-hmm. It's the week before to prepare for it. It is the week of, because that's a wash. And it's the week after of trying to follow up with everybody that I spoke with at the convention. Mm-hmm. And just recover and recoup, you know, from the experience. So every convention is darn near a month out of my time. So I'm really trying to evaluate what that's like. And then my role in my own company is starting to shift where I'm not the person that's there at the table running the demos.
Right.
That I my time is better spent, you know, elsewhere. So exploring that, because man, the work ethic in me and the worker bee in me has a real hard time not, you know, going there and kind of, you know, churning the sausage, so to speak, right? You know, it's a factory. You gotta, you know, play the game. People gotta see it. That's a part of the process. But I'm not the most valuable person to do that anymore, particularly because of the burnout, you know, of the perpetual demos. And everybody may not reach that point, but I think the burnout is a natural evolution of, hey, but doing this, you know, I've been slinging cardboard and hustling for 5 years. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't seem abnormal to me that I'm tired.
No, that's right? Totally understandable. I always seem to get the flu or something. I know I met you at PAX South, right?
Yeah.
And after that, it ruined 2 weeks of my Mexico stay because I had the flu and didn't want to get out of bed.
So yeah, and you don't want to have the flu in Mexico. You're already fighting the water, exactly. You know, yep. Fighting, you know, sanitary conditions. And I love Mexico. I've spent, you know, quite a bit of time down there, but it is a different, yeah. It is a third world country in a lot of respects. You know, so yeah, no, I get it. So now what conventions look like for me are, they are time for me to meet with other companies and have those meetings. They're time for me to meet with designers, to meet with artists, and to basically, you know, I love people and I love interacting with people. You know, one of my biggest personalities, you know, I took StrengthFinders in 2004. I took StrengthFinders 2.0 this past year, and my number one and number two, you know, personality traits are empathy and woo, winning others over. And so that, mm-hmm. that is a good time for me to go out there and genuinely love on people and check in with them, you know, and because it's real, because I actually care and I'm not just trying to be a used car salesman. I think that has benefited me because people know that I'm genuine and they know that I care.
Great.
So well, that's what I think it's like for me in the future.
Great. That's good. So do you sort of do a cost benefit analysis for each convention and pick, are you just picking specific ones to go to from now on?
Yeah, I think we look at, we, you know, my team looks at each convention differently. And one of the many, you know, amazing benefits of my partnership with Geek Chic is that they go to a lot of shows. And so I can, you know, decide to piggyback on that or not. And a lot of that too is based upon the space and the type of convention. San Diego Comic-Con is a zoo. Is that the best show for me?
Yeah.
Maybe not. The comic cons are great. They're a blast to attend. As a fan, I freak out, you know, and have a ton of fun, but it's not necessarily the best use, you know, of my time. And right. So I do kind of look at it, you know, for example, we're going to Tokyo Game Market next month, and this is a pure spec trip. You know, we want to find games over in Japan and games out of Taiwan and games out of Korea. And there's a well there that companies like AEG and Tasty Minstrel have begun to tap. And I believe that it's time for, for us to get involved, for Crash a Game to get involved in that market. So that's a very cost heavy trip, and there aren't any immediately tangible goals, but the people that show up, the people that go and do the thing, that's how you create luck. Luck is just opportunity meeting preparation. And I take that from my ex-business partner and still good friend, Michael Coe. And so that is what we always, and how we always operated, and how I continue to operate, is that you never know. But if you're out there and you have a dream, or you want to sell a thing, or you want to make a company, then yeah, you got to go to the things. You got to show up. You got to, you know, involve yourself. And the whole premise of fake it till you make it, that's not a bad, not a bad way to go.
I agree with that too. Yeah.
Yeah. I was, the first couple of years, was I really a publisher? That's subjective. You know, am I one now? Oh, definitively.
I came out of the gate calling myself the board game lawyer, but that it may or may not have been true. So yeah. Yeah. It's
You can create that, exactly, that reality. That is the great thing about the freedom that we have here, is that you got a dream, man, find out a way to make it work, and, and you can do it.
Yep, absolutely. Well, that's a great thought to end this on. I could talk to you all day, but unfortunately, we have a time limit, so I'll have to have you back on maybe in a month or so.
It'd be my pleasure anytime, Zach.
Great. Love chatting with you. That's going to do it for this episode. So thank you for coming on. Where can our listeners find you, Patrick?
So we just launched our new website a couple weeks ago, and so that's crashofgames.com. We've got our blog on there. Mm-hmm. You can interact, you know, via the comment section. You can always find me on Twitter at crash_games and our Facebook page at facebook.com/crashgames.
Great.
I always forget to mention our YouTube channel. Go subscribe to our YouTube channel, Crash of Games on YouTube. You can find a link on our website. I have a new segment I put out every Monday called 5 Minute Mondays, a great recap of what's going on. And we'll be adding some new content to our YouTube channel, as the months continue, that I think, I know I'm excited about, and I think people will enjoy as well.
Man, I need to do that. I'm very bad. I have a YouTube channel, but it's all videos of red pandas in China and stuff like that.
Bad thing. That's just you know, some clickbait. Go down a YouTube hole. Yeah.
No one's seen them.
Adorable animal.
Yeah. You can find me. My main site would be gamelawyerblog.com. You can read more about the legal aspects of game development there. You can go on iTunes and put a 5-star review for the show. And we also have a Patreon. So go to patreon.com/legalmoves to donate to the campaign. Patrick, thanks again. And listeners, I will see you next week.
Thank you, Zach.